Blood ran down her white throat from where the point of his dirk had pricked her. One thrust, and it's done, he told himself. He was so close, he could smell onion on her breath. She's no older than I am. Something about her made him think of Arya, although they look nothing at all alike. Will you yield, he asked, giving the dirk a half turn? And if she doesn't, I yield. Her words steamed in the cold air. You're our captive, then. He pulled the dirk away from the soft skin of her throat. Corrin said nothing about taking captives, said Stone Snake. He never said not to. John let go of his grip on the girl's hair, and she scuttled backward away from them. She's a spearwife. Stone Snake gestured at the long-hafted axe that lay beside her sleeping furs. She was reaching for that when you grabbed her. Give her half a chance, and she'll bury it between your eyes. I won't give her half a chance. John kicked the axe well out of the girl's reach. Do you have a name? Ygritte. A hand rubbed at her throat and came away bloody. She stared at the wetness. Sheathing his dirk, he wrenched Longclaw free from the body of the man he'd killed. You are my captive, Ygritte. I gave you my name. I'm Jon Snow. She flinched. An evil name. A bastard name, he said. My father was Lord Eddard Stark of Winterfell. The girl watched him warily, but Stone Snake gave a mordant chuckle. It's the captive supposed to tell things, remember? The ranger thrust a long branch into the fire. Not that she will. I've known wildlings to bite off their own tongues before they'd answer a question. When the end of the branch was blazing merrily, he took two steps and flung it out over the pass. It flew through the night, spinning until it was lost to sight. You ought to burn them you killed, said Ygritte. Need a bigger fire for that, and big fires burn bright, Stone Snake turned, his eyes scanning the black distance for any spark of flame. Are there more wildlings close by? Is that it? Burn them, the girl repeated stubbornly. Or it might be. You'll need them swords again. John remembered dead Uther and his cold black hands. Maybe we should do as she says. There are other ways. Stone Snake knelt beside the man he'd slain, stripping him of cloak and boots and belt and vest, then hoisted the body over one thin shoulder and carried it to the edge. He grunted as he tossed it over. A moment later, they heard a wet, heavy smack well below them. By then, the ranger had the second body down to the skin and was dragging it by the arms. John took the feet, and together they flung the dead man out into the blackness of the night. Ygritte watched and said nothing. She was older than he'd thought at first, John realized. Maybe as old as 20, but short for her age. Bandy-legged, with a round face, small hands, and a pug nose. Her shaggy mop of red hair stuck out in all directions. She looked plump as she crouched there, but most of that was layers of fur and wool and leather. Underneath all that, she could be as skinny as Arya. Were you sent to watch for us? John asked her. You and others. Stone Snake warmed his hands over the fire. What waits beyond the pass? The free folk. How many? Hundreds and thousands. More than you ever saw, Crow. She smiled. Her teeth were crooked but very white. She doesn't know how many. Why come here? Ygritte fell silent. What's in the Frostfangs that your king could want? You can't stay here. There's no food. She turned her face away from him. Do you mean to march on the wall? When? She stared at the flames as if she could not hear him. Do you know anything about my uncle, Benjen Stark? Ygritte ignored him. Stone Snake laughed. If she spits out her tongue, don't say I didn't warn you. A low rumbling growl echoed off the rock. Shadow Cat. John knew at once. As he rose, he heard another, closer at hand. He pulled his sword and turned, listening. They won't trouble us, Ygritte said. It's the dead they've come for. Cats can smell blood 6 miles off. They'll stay near the bodies till they've eaten every last stringy shred of meat and cracked the bones for the marrow. John could hear the sounds of their feeding echoing off the rocks. It gave him an uneasy feeling. The warmth of the fire had made him realize how bone-tired he was, but he dared not sleep. He had taken a captive, and it was on him to guard her. "Were they your kin?" he asked her quietly. "The two we killed?" "No more than you are."
"Me?" he frowned. "What do you mean?"
"You said you were the bastard of Winterfell."
"I am."
"Who was your mother?"
"Some woman. Most of them are.
Someone had said that to him once. He did not remember who."
She smiled again, a flash of white teeth.
"And she never sung you the song of the winter rose?"
"I never knew my mother, or any such song."
"Bale the Bard made it," said Ygritte. "He was king beyond the wall a long time back. All the free folk know his songs. But might be you don't sing them in the south."
"Winterfell's not in the south," John objected.
"Yes, it is. Everything below the wall's south to us."
He had never thought of it that way.
"I suppose it's all in where you're standing." "Aye," Ygritte agreed. "It always is."
"Tell me," John urged her. It would be hours before Corrin came up, and a story would help keep him awake.
"I want to hear this tale of yours." "Might be you won't like it much."
"I'll hear it all the same."
"Brave Black Crow," she mocked. "Well, long before he was king over the free folk, Bale was a great raider."
Stone Snake gave a snort.
"A murderer, robber, and raper is what you mean." "That's all in where you're standing, too," Ygritte said. "The Stark in Winterfell wanted Bale's head, but could never take him, and the taste of failure galled him. One day, in his bitterness, he called Bale a craven who preyed only on the weak. When word of that got back, Bale vowed to teach the Lord a lesson. So he scaled the wall, skipped down the King's Road, and walked into Winterfell one winter's night with harp in hand, naming himself Sigeric of Skagos. Sigeric means deceiver in the old tongue that the first men spoke and the giants still speak. North or south, singers always find a ready welcome, so Bale ate at Lord Stark's own table and played for the Lord in his high seat until half the night was gone. The old songs he played, and new ones he'd made himself. And he played and sang so well that when he was done, the Lord offered to let him name his own reward. "All I ask is a flower," Bale answered, "the fairest flower that blooms in the gardens of Winterfell." Now, as it happened, the winter roses had only then come into bloom, and no flower is so rare nor precious. So the Stark sent to his glass gardens and commanded that the most beautiful of the winter roses be plucked for the singer's payment. And so it was done. But when the morning come, the singer had vanished, and so had Lord Brandon's maiden daughter. Her bed they found empty, but for the pale blue rose that Bale had left on her pillow where her head had lain.
John had never heard this tale before. Which Brandon was this supposed to be? Brandon the Builder lived in the Age of Heroes, thousands of years before Bale. There was Brandon the Burner and his father, Brandon the Shipwright, but
this was Brandon the Daughterless, Ygritte said sharply. Would you hear the tale or no?
He scowled.
Go on. Lord Brandon had no other children. At his behest, the Black Crows flew forth from their castles in the hundreds, but nowhere could they find any sign of Bale or this maid. For most a year they searched, till the Lord lost heart and took to his bed, and it seemed as though the line of Starks was at its end. But one night, as he lay waiting to die, Lord Brandon heard a child's cry. He followed the sound and found his daughter back in her bedchamber, asleep, with a babe at her breast.
Bale had brought her back?
No, they had been in Winterfell all the time, hiding with the dead beneath the castle.
The maid loved Bale so dearly that she bore him a son, the song says. Now, if truth be told, all the maids loved Bale in them songs he wrote. Be that as it may, what's certain is that Bale left the child in payment for the rose he'd plucked unasked, and that the boy grew to be the next Lord Stark. So there it is. You have Bale's blood in you, same as me.
It never happened, John said. She shrugged.
Might be it did, might be it didn't. It's a good song, though. My mother used to sing it to me. She was a woman too, John Snow, like yours.
She rubbed her throat where his dirk had cut her.
The song ends when they find the babe. But there is a darker end to the story. 30 years later, when Bale was king beyond the wall and led the free folk south, it was young Lord Stark who met him at the frozen ford and killed him, for Bale would not harm his own son when they met sword to sword.
So the son slew the father instead, said John.
Aye, she said, but the guards hate kinslayers even when they kill unknowing. When Lord Stark returned from the battle and his mother saw Bale's head upon his spear, she threw herself from a tower in her grief. Her son did not long outlive her. One of his lords peeled the skin off him and wore him for a cloak.
Your Bale was a liar, he told her. Certain now.
No, Ygritte said. But a bard's truth is different from yours or mine. Anyway, you asked for the story, so I told it.
She turned away from him, closed her eyes, and seemed to sleep. Dawn and Corin Halfhand arrived together. The black stones had turned to grey, and the eastern sky had gone indigo when Stone Snake spied the rangers below, wending their way upward. John woke his captive and held her by the arm as they descended to meet them. Thankfully, there was another way off the mountain, to the north and west, along paths much gentler than the one that had brought them up here. They were waiting in the narrow defile when their brothers appeared, leading their garrons. Ghost raced ahead at first scent of them. John squatted to let the direwolf close his jaws around his wrist, tugging his hand back and forth. It was a game they played. But when he glanced up, he saw Ygritte watching with eyes as wide and white as hen's eggs. Corin Halfhand made no comment when he saw the prisoner.
There were three, Stone Snake told him.
No more than that.
We passed two, Eben said, or what the cats had left of them.
He eyed the girl sourly, suspicion plain on his face. She yielded, John felt compelled to say. Corin's face was impassive.
Do you know who I am?
Corin Halfhand.
The girl looked half a child beside him, but she faced him boldly.
Tell me true. If I fell into the hands of your people and yielded myself, what would it win me?
A slower death than elseways.
The big ranger looked to John.
We have no food to feed her, nor can we spare a man to watch her.
The way before us is perilous enough, lad, said Squire Dawbridge. One shout when we need silence, and every man of us is doomed.
Eben drew his dagger.
A steel kiss will keep her quiet.
John's throat was raw. He looked at them, all helplessly.
She yielded herself to me. Then you must do what needs be done,
Corin Halfhand said.
You are the blood of Winterfell and a man of the Night's Watch.
He looked at the others.
Come, brothers, leave him to it. It will go easier for him if we do not watch.
And he led them up the steep, twisting trail toward the pale pink glow of the sun, where it broke through a mountain cleft, and before very long, only John and Ghost remained with the wildling girl. He thought Ygritte might try to run, but she only stood there, waiting, looking at him.
You never killed a woman before, did you?
When he shook his head, she said,
We die the same as men, but you don't need to do it. Mance would take you. I know he would. There's secret ways. Them crows would never catch us.
I'm as much a crow as they are, John said.
She nodded, resigned.
Will you burn me after?
I can't. The smoke might be seen.
That's so, she shrugged. Well, there's worse places to end up than the belly of a shadow cat.
He pulled Longclaw over her shoulder. Aren't you afraid?
Last night I was, she admitted. But now the sun's up.
She pushed her hair aside to bare her neck and knelt before him.
Strike hard and true, Crow, or I'll come back and haunt you.
Longclaw was not so long or heavy a sword as his father's ice, but it was Valyrian steel all the same. He touched the edge of the blade to mark where the blow must fall. And Ygritte shivered.
That's cool, she said. Go on, be quick about it.
He raised Longclaw above his head, both hands tight around the grip.
One cut, with all my weight behind it.
He could give her a quick, clean death at least. He was his father's son.
Wasn't he? Wasn't he?
Do it, she urged him after a moment. Bastard, do it. I can't stay brave forever.
When the blow did not fall, she turned her head to look at him. John lowered his sword. Go, he muttered. Ygritte stared.
Now, he said, before my wits return. Go!
She went. Sansa. The southern sky was black with smoke. It rose, swirling off 100 distant fires, its sooty fingers smudging out the stars. Across the Blackwater Rush, a line of flame burned nightly from horizon to horizon, while on this side the imp had fired the whole riverfront, docks and warehouses, homes and brothels, everything outside the city walls. Even in the Red Keep, the air tasted of ashes. When Sansa found Ser Dontos in the quiet of the Guardswood, he asked if she'd been crying. It's only from the smoke, she lied. It looks as if half the Kingswood is burning.
Lord Stannis wants to smoke out the imp savages.
Dontos swayed as he spoke, one hand on the trunk of a chestnut tree. A wine stain discolored the red and yellow motley of his tunic.
They kill his scouts and raid his baggage train, and the wildlings have been lighting fires too. The imp told the queen that Stannis had better train his horses to eat ash, since he would find no blade of grass. I heard him say so. I hear all sorts of things, as a fool, that I never heard when I was a knight. They talk as though I'm not there, and...
He leaned close, breathing his whiny breath right in her face.
The spider pays in gold for any little trifle. I think Moonboy has been his for years.
He is drunk again. My poor Florian, he names himself, and so he is. But he is all I have. Is it true that Lord Stannis burned the Guardswood at Storm's End? Dontos nodded.
He made a great pyre of the trees as an offering to his new god. The Red Priestess made him do it. They say she rules him now, body and soul. He's vowed to burn the great Sept of Baelor, too, if he takes the city.
Let him. When Sansa had first beheld the great sept, with its marble walls and 7 crystal towers, she thought it was the most beautiful building in the world. But that had been before Joffrey beheaded her father on its steps. I want it burned.
Hush, child. The gods will hear you.
Why should they? They never hear my prayers.
Yes, they do. They sent me to you, didn't they?
Sansa picked at the bark of a tree. She felt light-headed, almost feverish. They sent you, but what good have you done? You promised you would take me home, but I'm still here. Dontos patted her arm.
I've spoken to a certain man I know, a good friend to me, and to you, my lady. He will hire a swift ship to take us to safety. When the time is right.
The time is right now, Sansa insisted, before the fighting starts.
They've forgotten about me. I know we could slip away if we tried.
Child, child, Dantès shook his head. Out of the castle, yes, we could do that. But the city gates are more heavily guarded than ever. And the imp has even closed off the river.
It was true. The Blackwater Rush was as empty as Sansa had ever seen it. All the ferries had been withdrawn to the north bank, and the trading galleys had fled, all been seized by the imp to be made over for battle. The only ships to be seen were the king's war galleys. They rowed endlessly up and down, staying to the deep water in the middle of the river, and exchanging flights of arrows with Stannis's archers on the south shore. Lord Stannis himself was still on the march, but his vanguard had appeared 2 nights ago during the Black of the Moon. King's Landing had woken to the sight of their tents and banners. There were 5,000, Sansa had heard, near as many as all the gold cloaks in the city. They flew the red or green apples of House Fossoway, the turtle of Estamont, and the fox and flowers of Florent, and their commander was Sir Gaillard Morrigan, a famous southern knight whom men now called Gaillard the Green. His standard showed a crow in flight, its black wings spread wide against the storm-green sky. But it was the pale yellow banners that worried the city. Long, ragged tails streamed behind them like flickering flames, and in place of a lord's sigil, they bore the device of a god, the burning heart of the Lord of Light. When Stannis comes, he'll have 10 times as many men as Joffrey does. Everyone says so. Dantès squeezed her shoulder.
The size of his host does not matter, sweetling, so long as they are on the wrong side of the river. Stannis cannot cross without ships.
He has ships, more than Joffrey.
It's a long sail from Storm's End. The fleet will need to come up Massey's Hook and through the Gullet and across Blackwater Bay. Perhaps the good gods will send a storm to sweep them from the seas.
Dantès gave a hopeful smile.
It's not easy for you, I know. You must be patient, child. When my friend returns to the city, we shall have our ship. Have faith in your Florian and try not to be afraid.
Sansa dug her nails into her hand. She could feel the fear in her tummy, twisting and pinching, worse every day. Nightmares of the day Princess Myrcella had sailed still troubled her sleep. Dark, suffocating dreams that woke her in the black of night, struggling for breath. She could hear the people screaming at her, screaming without words like animals. They had hemmed her in and thrown filth at her and tried to pull her off her horse, and would have done worse if the hound had not cut his way to her side. They had torn the High Septon to pieces and smashed Sir Aaron's head with a rock. Try not to be afraid, he said. The whole city was afraid. Sansa could see it from the castle walls. The small folk were hiding themselves behind closed shutters and barred doors, as if that would keep them safe. The last time King's Landing had fallen, the Lannisters looted and raped as they pleased and put hundreds to the sword, even though the city had opened its gates. This time the imp meant to fight, and a city that fought could expect no mercy at all. Dantès was prattling on.
If I were still a knight, I should have put on armor and manned the walls with the rest. I ought to kiss King Joffrey's feet and thank him sweetly.
If you thanked him for making you a fool, he'd make you a knight again, Sansa said sharply.
Dantès chuckled. My Junkle's a clever girl, isn't she?
Joffrey and his mother say I'm stupid.
Let them. You're safer that way, sweetling. Queen Cersei and the imp and Lord Varys and their like. They all watch each other, keen as hawks, and pay this one and that one to spy out what the others are doing. But no one ever troubles themselves over Lady Dander's daughter, do they? Dantès covered his mouth to stifle a burp.
God preserve you, my little Junkle.
He was growing weepy. The wine did that to him.
Give me a Florian little kiss now. A kiss for luck.
He swayed toward her. Sansa dodged the wet, groping lips, kissed him lightly on an unshaven cheek, and bid him good night.
It took all her strength not to weep. She had been weeping too much of late. It was unseemly, she knew, but she could not seem to help herself. The tears would come sometimes over a trifle, and nothing she did could hold them back. The drawbridge to Magor's holdfast was unguarded. The imp had moved most of the gold cloaks to the city walls, and the white knights of the King's Guard had duties more important than dodging her heels. Sansa could go where she would, so long as she did not try to leave the castle, but there was nowhere she wanted to go. She crossed over the dry moat with its cruel iron spikes and made her way up the narrow turnpike stair. But when she reached the door of her bedchamber, she could not bear to enter. The very walls of the room made her feel trapped. Even with the window open wide, it felt as though there was no air to breathe. Turning back to the stair, Sansa climbed. The smoke blotted out the stars and the thin crescent of moon. So the roof was dark and thick with shadows. Yet from here she could see everything. The Red Keep's tall towers and great corner forts, the maze of city streets beyond, to south and west, the river running black, the bay to the east, the columns of smoke and cinders, and fires, fires everywhere. Soldiers crawling over the city walls like ants with torches, and crowded the hoardings that had sprouted from the ramparts. Down by the mud gate, outlined against the drifting smoke, she could make out the vague shape of the three huge catapults, the biggest anyone had ever seen, overtopping the walls by a good 20 feet. Yet none of it made her feel less fearful. A stab went through her, so sharp that Sansa sobbed and clutched at her belly. She might have fallen, but a shadow moved suddenly, and strong fingers grabbed her arm and steadied her. She grabbed a merlon for support, her fingers scrabbling at the rough stone. "Let go of me," she cried. "Let go."
"The little bird thinks she has wings, does she? Or do you mean to end up crippled like that brother of yours?"
Sansa twisted in his grip. "I wasn't going to fall. I was only... You startled me, that's all."
"You mean I scared you? And still do."
She took a deep breath to calm herself. "I thought I was alone. She glanced away.
"The little bird still can't bear to look at me, can she?"
The hound released her.
"You were glad enough to see my face when the mob had you, though. Remember?"
Sansa remembered all too well. She remembered the way they had howled, the feel of the blood running down her cheek from where the stone had struck her, and the garlic stink on the breath of the man who had tried to pull her from her horse. She could still feel the cruel pinch of fingers on her wrist as she lost her balance and began to fall. She thought she was going to die then, but the fingers had twitched, all five at once, and the man had shrieked loud as a horse. When his hand fell away, another hand, stronger, shoved her back into her saddle. The man with the garlicky breath was on the ground, blood pumping out of the stump of his arm. But there were others all around, some with clubs in hand. The hound leapt at them, his sword a blur of steel that trailed a red mist as it swung. When they broke and ran before him, he had laughed, his terrible burned face for a moment transformed. She made herself look at that face now, really look. It was only courteous, and a lady must never forget her courtesies. The scars are not the worst part, nor even the way his mouth twitches. It's his eyes. She had never seen eyes so full of anger. I should have come to you after, she said haltingly, to thank you for saving me. You were so brave.
Brave?
His laugh was half a snarl.
A dog doesn't need courage to chase off rats. They had me 30-1, and not a man of them dared face me.
She hated the way he talked, always so harsh and angry. Does it give you joy to scare people?
No, it gives me joy to kill people.
His mouth twitched.
Wrinkle up your face all you like, but spare me this false piety. You and I, lords, get. Don't tell me Lord Eddard Stark of Winterfell never killed a man.
That was his duty,
He never liked it.
Is that what he told you?
Clegane laughed again.
Your father lied. Killing is the sweetest thing there is.
He drew his longsword.
Here's your truth. Your precious father found that out on Baelor's steps. Lord of Winterfell, Hand of the King, Warden of the North, the mighty Eddard Stark, of a line 8,000 years old. But Ilion Payne's blade went through his neck all the same, didn't it? Do you remember the dance he did when his head came off his shoulders?
Sansa hugged herself, suddenly cold. Why are you always so hateful? I was thanking you.
Just as if I was one of those true knights you love so well, yes. What do you think a knight is for, girl? You think it's all taking favours from ladies and looking fine in gold plate? Knights are for killing.
He laid the edge of his longsword against her neck, just under her ear. Sansa could feel the sharpness of the steel.
I killed my first man at 12. I've lost count of how many I've killed since then. High lords with old names, fat rich men dressed in velvet, knights puffed up like bladders with their honours, yes, and women, and children too. They're all meat, and I'm the butcher. Let them have their lands, and their guards, and their gold. Let them have their sirs.
Sandor Clegane spat at her feet to show what he thought of that.
So long as I have this,
he said, lifting the sword from her throat,
there's no man on earth I need fear.
Except your brother, Sansa thought, but she had better sense than to say it aloud. He is a dog, just as he says. A half-wild, mean-tempered dog that bites any hand that tries to pet him, and yet will savage any man who tries to hurt his masters. Not even the men across the river? Clegane's eyes turned toward the distant fires.
All this burning.
He sheathed his sword.
Only cowards fight with fire.
Lord Stannis is no coward.
He's not the man his brother was either. Robert never let a little thing like your river stop him.
What will you do when he crosses it?
Fight, kill, die maybe.
Aren't you afraid? The guards might send you down to some terrible hell for all the evil you've done.
What evil?
He laughed.
What gods?
The gods who made us all.
All? He mocked. Tell me, little bird, what kind of god makes a monster like the imp, or a half-wit like Lady Tander's daughter? If there are gods, they made sheep so wolves could eat mutton, and they made the weak for the strong to play with.
True knights protect the weak.
Tchah!
He snorted.
There are no true knights, no more than there are gods. If you can't protect yourself, die and get out of the way of those who can. Sharp steel and strong arms rule this world. Don't ever believe any different.
Sansa backed away from him. You're awful.
I'm honest. It's the world that's awful. Now fly away, little bird. I'm sick of you peeping at me.
Wordless, she fled. She was afraid of Sandor Clegane. And yet, some part of her wished that Ser Dontos had a little of the hound's ferocity. There are gods, she told herself, and there are true knights, too. All the stories can't be lies. That night, Sansa dreamed of the riot again. The mob surged around her, shrieking, a maddened beast with 1,000 faces. Everywhere she turned, she saw faces twisted into monstrous, inhuman masks. She wept and told them she had never done them hurt, yet they dragged her from her horse all the same. No, she cried. No, please, don't. But no one paid her any heed. She shouted for Ser Dontos, for her brothers, for her dead father and her dead wolf, for gallant Ser Loras, who had given her a red rose once. But none of them came. She called for the heroes from the songs, for Florian and Ser Raymond Redwine, and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, but no one heard. Women swarmed over her like weasels, pinching her legs and kicking her in the belly, and someone hit her in the face, and she felt her teeth shatter.
Then she saw the bright glimmer of steel. The knife plunged into her belly and tore and tore and tore until there was nothing left of her down there but shiny, wet ribbons. When she woke, the pale light of morning was slanting through her window, yet she felt as sick and achy as if she had not slept at all. There was something sticky on her thighs. When she threw back the blanket and saw the blood, all she could think was that her dream had somehow come true. She remembered the knives inside her twisting and ripping. She squirmed away in horror, kicking at the sheets and falling to the floor, breathing raggedly, naked, bloodied, and afraid. But as she crouched there on her hands and knees, understanding came. "No, please," Sansa whimpered. "Please, no." She didn't want this happening to her. Not now, not here, not now, not now, not now, not now. Madness took hold of her. Pulling herself up by the bedpost, she went to the basin and washed between her legs, scrubbing away all the stickiness. By the time she was done, the water was pink with blood. When her maidservants saw it, they would know. Then she remembered the bedclothes. She rushed back to the bed and stared in horror at the dark red stain and the tale it told. All she could think was that she had to get rid of it, or else they'd see. She couldn't let them see, or they'd marry her to Joffrey and make her lay with him. Snatching up her knife, Sansa hacked at the sheet, cutting out the stain. "If they ask me about the hole, what will I say?" Tears ran down her face. She pulled the torn sheet from the bed and the stained blanket as well. "I'll have to burn them." She balled up the evidence, stuffed it in the fireplace, drenched it in oil from her bedside lamp, and lit it a fire. Then she realized that the blood had soaked through the sheet into the feather bed, so she bundled that up as well, but it was big and cumbersome, hard to move. Sansa could only get half of it into the fire. She was on her knees, struggling to shove the mattress into the flames, as thick gray smoke eddied around her and filled the room, when the door burst open, and she heard a maid gasp. In the end, it took three of them to pull her away. And it was all for nothing. The bedclothes were burned, but by the time they'd carried her off, her thighs were bloody again. It was as if her own body had betrayed her to Joffrey, unfurling a banner of Lannister crimson for all the world to see. When the fire was out, they carried off the singed feather bed, fanned away the worst of the smoke, and brought up a tub. Women came and went, muttering and looking at her strangely. They filled the tub with scalding hot water, bathed her and washed her hair, and gave her a cloth to wear between her legs. By then, Sansa was calm again and ashamed for her folly. The smoke had ruined most of her clothing. One of the women went away and came back with a green wool shift that was almost her size.
"It's not as pretty as your own things, but it will serve," she announced when she pulled it down over Sansa's head. "Your shoes weren't burnt, so at least you won't need to go barefoot to the Queen."
Cersei Lannister was breaking her fast when Sansa was ushered into her solar. "You may sit," the Queen said graciously. "Are you hungry?" She gestured at the table. There was porridge, honey, milk, boiled eggs, and crisp fried fish. The sight of the food made Sansa feel ill. Her tummy was tied in a knot. "No, thank you, Your Grace." "I don't blame you. Between Tyrion and Lord Stannis, everything I eat tastes of ash. And now you're setting fires as well. What did you hope to accomplish?" Sansa lowered her head. "The blood frightened me." "The blood is the seal of your womanhood. Lady Catelyn might have prepared you. You've had your first flowering, no more." Sansa had never felt less flowery. "My lady mother told me, but I thought it would be different."
"Different how?"
"I don't know, less messy and more magical." Queen Cersei laughed. "Wait until you birth a child, Sansa. A woman's life is nine parts mess to one part magic. You'll learn that soon enough.
and all the parts that look like magic often turn out to be messiest of all. She took a sip of milk. So now you're a woman. Do you have the least idea of what that means?
It means that I'm now fit to be wedded and bedded, said Sansa, and to bear children for the king.
The queen gave her a wry smile.
A prospect that no longer entices you as it once did, I can see. I will not fault you for that. Joffrey has always been difficult. Even his birth. I labored a day and a half to bring him forth. You cannot imagine the pain, Sansa. I screamed so loudly that I fancied Robert might hear me in the Kingswood.
His Grace was not with you?
Robert? Robert was hunting. That was his custom. Whenever my time was near, my royal husband would flee to the trees with his huntsmen and hounds. When he returned, he would present me with some pelts or a stag's head, and I would present him with a baby. Not that I wanted him to stay, mind you. I had Grand Maester Pycelle and an army of bitwives, and I had my brother. When they told Jaime he was not allowed in the birthing room, he smiled and asked which of them proposed to keep him out. Joffrey will show you no such devotion, I fear. You could thank your sister for that, if she weren't dead. He's never been able to forget that day on the Trident when you saw her shame him. So he shames you in turn. You're stronger than you seem, though. I expect you'll survive a bit of humiliation. I did. You may never love the king, but you'll love his children.
I love his grace with all my heart, Sansa said. The queen sighed.
You'd best learn some new lies, and quickly. Lord Stannis will not like that one, I promise you. The new High Septon said that the guards will never permit Lord Stannis to win, since Joffrey is the rightful king. A half-smile flickered across the queen's face. Robert's true-born son and heir. Though Joff would cry whenever Robert picked him up. His Grace did not like that. His bastards had always gurgled at him happily and sucked his finger when he put it in their little base-born mouths. Robert wanted smiles and cheers, always, so he went where he found them, to his friends and his whores. Robert wanted to be loved. My brother Tyrion has the same disease. Do you want to be loved, Sansa?
Everyone wants to be loved.
I see that flowering hasn't made you any brighter, said Cersei. Sansa, permit me to share a bit of womanly wisdom with you on this very special day. Love is poison. A sweet poison, yes. But it will kill you all the same.
John. It was dark in the Skirling Pass. The great stone flanks of the mountains hid the sun for most of the day, so they rode in shadow, the breath of man and horse steaming in the cold air. Icy fingers of water trickled down from the snowpack above into small frozen pools that cracked and broke beneath the hooves of their garrons. Sometimes they would see a few weeds struggling from some crack in the rock, a splotch of pale lichen, but there was no grass. And they were above the trees now. The track was as steep as it was narrow, wending its way ever upward. Where the pass was so constricted the rangers had to go single file, Squire Dalbridge would take the lead, scanning the heights as he went, his longbow ever close to hand. It was said he had the keenest eyes in the night's watch. Ghost padded restlessly by John's side. From time to time he would stop and turn, his ears pricked, as if he heard something behind them. John did not think the Shadow Cats would attack living men, not unless they were starving, but he loosened Longclaw in its scabbard even so. A wind-carved arch of grey stone marked the highest point of the pass. Here the way broadened as it began its long descent toward the Valley of the Milkwater. Corrin decreed that they would rest here until the shadows began to grow again.
Shadows are friends to men in black, he said.
John saw the sense of that. It would be pleasant to ride in the light for a time, to let the bright mountain sun soak through their cloaks and chase the chill from their bones, but they dared not. Where there were three watchers, there might be others, waiting to sound the alarm. Stonesnake curled up under his ragged fur cloak and was asleep almost at once. John shared his salt beef with Ghost, while Eben and Squire Dalbridge fed the horses. Corran Halfhand sat with his back to a rock, honing the edge of his longsword with long, slow strokes. John watched the ranger for a few moments, then summoned his courage and went to him. "My lord," he said, "you never asked me how it went with the girl." "I am no lord, Jon Snow." Corran slid the stone smoothly along the steel with his two-fingered hand. "She told me Mance would take me if I ran with her. She told you true. She even claimed we were kin. She told me a story of Bale, the bard, and the Rose of Winterfell. So Stonesnake told me. It happens I know the song. Mance would sing it of old when he came back from arranging. He had a passion for wildling music. Aye, and for their women as well. You knew him?" "We all knew him." His voice was sad. They were friends as well as brothers, John realized, and now they're sworn foes. "Why did he desert? For a wench, some say. For a crown, others would have it." Corran tested the edge of his sword with the ball of his thumb. "He liked women, Mance did, and he was not a man whose knees bent easily, that's true. But it was more than that. He loved the wild better than the war. It was in his blood. He was wildling born, taken as a child when some raiders were put to the sword. When he left the Shadow Tower, he was only going home again." "Was he a good ranger?" "He was the best of us," said the Halfhand. "And the worst as well. Only fools like Thorin Smallwood despise the wildlings. They are as brave as we are, John. As strong, as quick, as clever. But they have no discipline. They name themselves the Free Folk, and each one thinks himself as good as a king and wiser than a maester. Mance was the same. He never learned how to obey." "No more than me," said John quietly. Corrin's shrewd grey eyes seemed to see right through him. "So, you let her go?" He did not sound the least surprised. "You know?" "Now. Tell me why you spared her." It was hard to put into words. "My father never used a headsman. He said he owed it to the men he killed to look into their eyes and hear their last words. And when I looked into Ygritte's eyes, I..." John stared down at his hands helplessly. "I know she was an enemy, but there was no evil in her.
No more than in the other two."
"It was their lives or ours," John said. "If they had seen us, if they had sounded that horn..."
"The Wildlings would hunt us down and slay us, true enough."
"Stonesnake has the horn now, though, and we took Ygritte's knife and axe. She's behind us, afoot, unarmed."
"And not like to be a threat," Corran agreed. "If I had needed her dead, I would have left her with Eben, or done the thing myself."
"Then why did you command it of me?"
"I did not command it. I told you to do what needed to be done, and left you to decide what that would be."
Corran stood and slid his longsword back into its scabbard.
"When I want a mountain scaled, I call on Stonesnake. Should I need to put an arrow through the eye of some foe across a windy battlefield, I summon Squire Dalbridge. Eben can make any man give up his secrets. To lead men, you must know them, Jon Snow. I know more of you now than I did this morning."
"And if I had slain her?" asked Jon.
"She would be dead, and I would know you better than I had before. But enough talk. You ought to be sleepy. We have leagues to go and dangers to face. You will need your strength."
John did not think sleep would come easily, but he knew the Halfhand was right. He found a place out of the wind beneath an overhang of rock and took off his cloak to use it for a blanket. "Ghost," he called, "here, to me." He always slept better with the great white wolf beside him. There was comfort in the smell of him and welcome warmth in that shaggy, pale fur. This time, though, Ghost did no more than look at him. Then he turned away and padded around the garrons, and quick as that, he was gone.
"He wants to hunt," John thought.
Perhaps there were goats in these mountains. The shadow cats must live on something.
Just don't try and bring down a cat, he muttered. Even for a dire wolf, that would be dangerous. He tugged his cloak over him and stretched out beneath the rock.
When he closed his eyes, he dreamed of dire wolves. There were five of them, where there should have been six, and they were scattered, each apart from the others. He felt a deep ache of emptiness, a sense of incompleteness. The forest was vast and cold, and they were so small, so lost. His brothers were out there somewhere, and his sister, but he had lost their scent. He sat on his haunches and lifted his head to a darkening sky, and his cry echoed through the forest, a long, lonely, mournful sound. As it died away, he pricked up his ears, listening for an answer. But the only sound was a sigh of blowing snow.
John.
The call came from behind him, softer than a whisper, but strong, too.
Can a shout be silent?
He turned his head, searching for his brother, for a glimpse of a lean, grey shape moving beneath the trees. But there was nothing, only a weirwood. It seemed to sprout from solid rock, its pale roots twisting up from a myriad of fissures and hairline cracks. The tree was slender compared to other weirwoods he had seen, no more than a sapling. It was growing as he watched, its limbs thickening as they reached for the sky. Wary, he circled the smooth white trunk until he came to the face. Red eyes looked at him. Fierce eyes they were, yet glad to see him. The weirwood had his brother's face. Had his brother always had three eyes?
Not always,
came the silent shout.
Not before the crow.
He sniffed at the bark, smelled wolf and tree and boy, and behind that there were other scents. The rich brown smell of warm earth and the hard grey smell of stone and something else. Something terrible. Death, he knew. He was smelling death. He cringed back, his hair bristling, and bared his fangs.
Don't be afraid. I like it in the dark. No one can see you, but you can see them. But first, you have to open your eyes. See? Like this.
And the tree reached down and touched him. And suddenly, he was back in the mountains, his paws sunk deep in a drift of snow as he stood upon the edge of a great precipice. Before him, the skirling pass opened up into an airy emptiness, and a long V-shaped valley lay spread beneath him like a quilt, awash in all the colours of an autumn afternoon. A vast blue-white wall plugged one end of the vale, squeezing between the mountains as if it had shouldered them aside, and for a moment he thought he had dreamed himself back to Castle Black. Then he realized he was looking at a river of ice, several thousand feet high. Under that glittering cold cliff was a great lake, its deep cobalt waters reflecting the snow-capped peaks that ringed it. There were men down in the valley. He saw now many men, thousands, a huge host. Some were tearing great holes in the half-frozen ground, while others trained for war. He watched as a swarming mass of riders charged a shield wall, astride horses no larger than ants. The sound of their mock battle was a rustling of steel leaves, drifting faintly on the wind. Their encampment had no plan to it. He saw no ditches, no sharpened stakes, no neat rows of horse lines. Everywhere, crude earthen shelters and hide tents sprouted haphazardly like a pox upon the face of the earth. He spied untidy mounds of hay, smelled goats and sheep, horses and pigs, dogs in great profusion. Tendrils of dark smoke rose from a thousand cook fires.
This is no army, no more than it is a town. This is a whole people come together.
Across the long lake, one of the mounds moved. He watched it more closely and saw that it was not dirt at all, but alive, a shaggy, lumbering beast, with a snake for a nose and tusks, larger than those of the greatest boar that had ever lived. And the thing riding it was huge as well, and his shape was wrong, too thick in the leg and hips to be a man. Then a sudden gust of cold made his fur stand up, and the air thrilled to the sound of wings. As he lifted his eyes to the ice-white mountain heights above, a shadow plummeted out of the sky. A shrill scream split the air. He glimpsed blue-gray pinions spread wide, shutting out the sun. "Ghost!" John shouted, sitting up. He could still feel the talons, the pain. "Ghost! To me!" Eben appeared, grabbed him, shook him.
"Quiet! You mean to bring the wildlings down on us? What's wrong with you, boy?"
A dream, said John feebly. "I was Ghost. I was on the edge of the mountain looking down on a frozen river, and something attacked me. A bird, an eagle, I think." Squire Dawbridge smiled.
"It's always pretty women in my dreams. Would that I dream more often."
Curran came up beside him. "A frozen river, you say?" "The meltwater flows from a great lake at the foot of a glacier," Stone Snake put in. "There was a tree with my brother's face. The wildlings, there were thousands, more than I ever knew existed, and giants riding mammoths." From the way the light had shifted, John judged that he had been asleep for 4 or 5 hours. His head ached, and the back of his neck, where the talons had burned through him. But that was in the dream. "Tell me all that you remember, from first to last," said Corin Halfhand. John was confused. It was only a dream. "A wolf dream," the Halfhand said. "Craster told the Lord Commander that the wildlings were gathering at the source of the Miltwater. That may be why you dreamed it, or it may be that you saw what waits for us a few hours farther on. Tell me." It made him feel half a fool to talk about such things to Corin and the other rangers, but he did as he was commanded. None of the Black Brothers laughed at him, however. By the time he was done, even Squire Dawbridge was no longer smiling.
"Skin changer," said Eben grimly, looking at the Halfhand.
"Does he mean the eagle?" John wondered. "Or me?"
Skin changers and wargs belonged in old Nan stories, not in the world he had lived in all his life. Yet here, in this strange, bleak wilderness of rock and ice, it was not hard to believe.
The cold winds are rising. Mormont feared as much. Benjen Stark felt it as well. Dead men walk and the trees have eyes again. Why should we balk at wargs and giants?
"Does this mean my dreams are true as well?" asked Squire Dawbridge. "Lord Snow can keep his mammoths. I want my women."
"Man and boy, I've served the watch, and ranged as far as any, Sir Nevin. I've seen the bones of giants, and heard many a queer tale, but no more. I want to see them with my own eyes."
"Be careful they don't see you, Eben," Stone Snake said.
Ghost did not reappear as they set out again. The shadows covered the floor of the pass by then, and the sun was sinking fast toward the jagged twin peaks of the huge mountain the rangers called Forktop. If the dream was true, even the thought scared him. Could the eagle have hurt Ghost or knocked him off the precipice? And what about the weirwood with his brother's face that smelled of death and darkness? The last ray of sun vanished behind the peaks of Forktop. Twilight filled the skirling pass. It seemed to grow colder almost at once. They were no longer climbing. In fact, the ground had begun to descend, though as yet not sharply. It was littered with cracks and broken boulders and tumbled heaps of rock. It will be dark soon, and still no sign of Ghost. It was tearing John apart, yet he dared not shout for the dire wolf as he would have liked. Other things might be listening as well.
"Curran," Squire Dawbridge called softly. "There, look."
The eagle was perched on a spine of rock far above them, outlined against the darkening sky. We've seen other eagles, John thought. That need not be the one I dreamed of. Even so,